Hi, it's Dr. Weitz. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of the Private Medical Practice Academy.
So today I'm here with Dr. Brent Lacey, who is a practicing gastroenterologist. He's currently an employed physician in a large GI practice and is about to become partner, hopefully in the next year or so. And today we're also going to talk about his work as the founder of Scope of Practice and the summit he's having called Marriage and Money MD. So Brent, so great to have you here. I'm really excited to have this conversation about money and marriage and just trying to figure out, okay, if I want to have a new venture, if I want to join a practice where I become a partner, whether I start my own practice, whether I buy into an ASC or an endoscopy center in your case, kind of your thoughts about how do you have that conversation with your spouse to start with, because obviously you got to convince them that this is worth putting up money for.
Yeah, 100%. Well, and thanks for having me on. I'm very passionate about this topic. I think this is one of those things that a lot of times we either kind of put our head in the sand and just kind of go forward without asking enough questions, or we just kind of let the chips fall where they may and just kind of accept that this is the way things are. And I think having really informed conversations about these topics is hugely important.
So, you know, I know that you and I chatted about the fact that you are thinking about buying into this endoscopy center when you get to be a partner. Have you thought about how you're going to come up with the money to do that? Because I know that people, when they are thinking about starting a practice, they think about the startup costs. When you think about, you know, buying into or starting your own surgery center or whatever ancillary revenue stream it's going to be, you have to have cash. So where does that cash come from?
Well, my first thought is I would go deep sea diving and see if I could find treasure in a sunken pirate ship, but that doesn't seem like it's going to be a very fruitful venture. I've looked into that. It doesn't seem to have a high yield. What most people end up doing and what we will likely end up doing is taking out a loan for purchasing the share of the endoscopy center. And it's challenging to think about that. I cut my teeth as a financial coach doing Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University at my church, probably taught it 12 or 13 times. And Dave takes a very hard line stance about debt. It's, you know, it's like no debt ever, not for any reason, doesn't distinguish between business debt, personal debt, mortgage debt, non-mortgage debt. It's all just bad. And I understand why he has to take that line. That's the only way he can really have integrity to push the message that he does. But I think that's an oversimplified view of things, especially when you start getting into the kind of income ranges and the kind of business ventures that physicians very commonly can be a part of. So every partner that I know of that has bought into the endoscopy center or bought into the practice has done so using either money they were able to scrape together by, you know, selling stocks they had or selling other assets they had, or they, in most cases, took out a loan that they then tried to pay back fairly quickly.
So, you know, it's interesting that you talk about selling things, right? Like stocks. So, you know, I would like you to talk briefly about the concept of arbitrage, because if you think about it, if the stock market is booming, right, and I cash out of a position, number one, I may have a significant capital gains burden, right? But also if I take that money out, it no longer has an opportunity to grow, right? In comparison, if I take a loan, particularly if I can get a favorable rate, then, you know, maybe I actually am making more by not cashing out my stocks.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really the challenging part of this is that balancing act. Now there's two aspects to this. There's the math aspect that you just described, and then there's the risk aspect. So let's talk about the math aspect, right? So let's say you've got your money in, just for conservative purposes, we'll say in an S&P 500 index fund growing on average 7-8% per year, which is the historic average of the S&P 500. And then you're going to sell that. There's going to be some tax event, presumably. And then you put that into the let's say in this case, the endoscopy center or an ambulatory surgery center. And let's say that that's making 12% year on year or 20% year on year or whatever it is. So you're now trading the growth rate of a, of the stock market for the growth rate of the endoscopy center. But like you said, if you take the, if instead you say, well, what if I just leave that money in the stock market and it's growing at 7 or 8%, and then I borrow the money to invest in the endoscopy center. Now, I'm getting 20%, let's say, growth, but I'm having to pay back at 4 or 5% or whatever the interest rate is. And so your net is actually 15 instead of the net being, you know, 20 minus the value of the stock market growth. So that's kind of the, that's the difference between, you know, cashing out a position versus taking out a loan. Now that's
except
the math.
Hold on for a second, except that in that example, right? I made 20%. I paid 5% for the loan. So my net is 15. But meanwhile, I didn't have the tax event on the sale of my stock, right? And my stock is still in play, able to continue to grow.
Right. So now that's so true. So that is the argument in favor of doing the leveraged position of taking out the loan to buy into this endoscopy center. Now, mathematically, that sounds like a no-brainer. But then you got to take into account the second portion. And this is where I think it's really important for couples to sit down and decide what is your risk tolerance. So let's say, as an example, your share of buying into this ambulatory surgery center, just for round numbers, we'll say it's $500,000. Okay. It's, you know, it could be anywhere from that to $1.5 million. I mean, depending on where you're at, how big the center is, but let's say $500,000 for argument's sake. So now you have the question of, okay, are we comfortable with the idea of having a $500,000 loan on our balance sheet that is going to generate, you know, say $4,000 a month, $3,000 a month as a constant loan payment that is going to affect our cash flow for years to come? That's an important question to ask. And it sort of skirts past the mathematical issue. So you have to balance the potential for growth against the risk and the loss of some flexibility in terms of your cash flow position of taking out the loan. And everybody's a little bit different with that. And I think every deal is a little bit different also. So if you're joining a group that has a 20-year track record of doing these kinds of buy-ins with other partners, and it's been growing just like gangbusters, 20% year on year on year, that's a pretty low risk investment. It's probably worth considering. But if you're joining a group that they've had three splits in the partnerships, and, you know, because personality conflicts or whatever, and, you know, you're in a town that there's a lot of competition and new practices are springing up all the time, and you're constantly worried about filling your endoscopy center, that's a different kind of situation. So I think you have to take each deal as it comes and look beyond just the math at all the different aspects, including your risk tolerance, the track record of the deal, the partnership that you're joining, and your spouse's comfort level with what you're going to do.
Well, and I think that that's especially true. For example, if you have somebody who, let's say, is not buying into an existing thing, let's say you want to start it from scratch, right? You have some amount of a startup cost, and you really have to have a thorough analysis of what are those startup costs? What are my financial projections? How long is it going to be before I break even? Let's say I go out and take that loan for that startup cost. How long is it going to be before I can actually repay that, right? And understand that that spouse is on the hook for that as well. Because if you go out and take the loan, right, now you're going to have to provide a personal guarantee. And if you're married, the expectation is that both of you are going to sign that personal guarantee. And I think that for a lot of people, there's this huge fear because they don't actually understand their own financial projections, and they can't really evaluate a deal from a purely mathematical perspective. And I think you're right. It all boils down to your risk tolerance, but the risk tolerance has to be based on factual information, not on your gut.
Yeah. And as much as I, as a gastroenterologist, love trusting my gut, it's not a good business strategy. panic is not a good business strategy. Going by your gut instinct is not a good business strategy. 100% agree. You need facts, you need data, you need analysis. And so if you're in a startup position, that's a very different situation than if you're coming into an area where you've got a 20-year track record of success year after year after year. And so a lot of times what I'll recommend for folks is that not only do they need to do their own analysis, I think it's worth getting an independent analysis. You know, have someone who is familiar with these kind of deals, either a CPA or a tax advisor or someone who can look at those kinds of deals and say, okay, here's what's projected to be, your growth over the next 3 or 4 years. Here's how long it'll probably take for you to break even. Here's the places where you could suffer a catastrophic loss of, your investment. And you got to decide, is that really worth it? And maybe it is. And at the end of the day, some people may look at that and go, the upside of this is pretty high, but the downside is so high. I don't know if I'll be able to sleep at night. And maybe that deal's just not for you, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you're doing that kind of thing and taking out a loan, you gotta, expect that there's potential for loss there, and you have to factor that into your thinking.
Well, there's always, potential for loss. I think that realistically, whether you're starting a practice, whether you have a practice and you want to expand it, whether you want to buy into some center, you want to add a revenue stream, these are all no different than deciding whether you should buy Doximity stock or Apple stock or anybody else's stock. Okay. You have to really evaluate the business. And one of the things that you and I talked about earlier was the need to have transparency. Okay. And that if you're buying into something, that obviously whoever you're buying from needs to be transparent with you so you can make the best educated decision. But, especially as we're here to talk about, in part, the relationship with your spouse as, a partner in this investment decision, I also think that we need to stress the need for transparency with your partner. Because if you tell the partner, hey, I think, we need $100,000, but we're going to break even in 6 months, and then we can go to Europe as we had planned, even though I'm using that nest egg, right? And it really takes 3 years to get there. What do you think happens to that marriage?
I think they're going to struggle. But the thing I would say about that that's important is that a conversation about that kind of thing needs to not be the first conversation you have about finances. So that's the first thing I would say. So I think it's really important for any married couple to get in the habit of having congenial conversations about money. Money struggles, money problems, money fights are the number one source of marital discord and disharmony in the United States. It's the number one source for divorce too. It is very contentious, and it touches every part of our life. And so if you're not used to talking about money with regard to small things, then you come to your spouse and say, hey, listen, we're going to need to borrow $750,000 this year. I'm not sure how long it's going to take us to get that back. Just wanted to give you the heads up on that. That's not going to go well. So you need to have a foundation of good, positive conversations where you've talked about simple stuff like where are we going to vacation in the summer? How much do we want to spend for Christmas, for Christmas presents? Are we going to send the kids to private school or not? How often do we want to be eating out? What kind of cars do we want to drive? Do we really want to do this renovation for the house, or do we want to wait 3 years and save up some more money for it? Those are the kinds of conversations you need to be already having, so that when one of these conversations comes up where it's something really huge like this, it's not that big of a leap. You're not going from no conversation to this massive shock. You're going from small conversation to medium conversation to this is just sort of the next step. And it's very important to have that foundation built.
Well, especially because I think that for a lot of docs, the opportunity to start a practice or buy into something occurs at the same time that they may still have a fair amount of med school debt. They may be considering, should I buy a house? or to your point, we bought a house and now we are renovating the house or want to renovate the house. And it also comes at the same time that they have little kids. And so, you know, would love to hear your take on how do you juggle all of those competing interests when you're thinking about how do I, you know, invest in my own career by buying into or starting these things, and yet I have all these competing factors.
Yeah. So I think it starts by having a plan. You need to have conversations with your spouse about what do you really want out of life? What are your ultimate goals? When do you want to retire? What kind of schools do you want to send your kids to? What kind of lifestyle do you want to have? You need to have those conversations about what your actual goals are so that you're going on the same page. The second thing is that you need to build margin into your life. Okay. You need to have cushion. So if you're constantly living at and just barely riding the edge of breaking even and always worried that one little thing is going to push you over the edge. Like if your transmission blows in your car and it's a financial catastrophe for you, you're living too close to the edge. And so one of the things that I always recommend for folks is if they haven't done this already, you know, and this, a lot of times people hear this and they start going, oh no, I'm not doing that. Or I don't want to do that, is put a budget together, call it whatever you want, call it a cash flow plan, call it the number column on my yellow piece of paper that shall remain nameless, you know, whatever you want to call it, but sit down and make a plan for how you want to spend your money. And it is a very simple, basic math equation. Okay. If you make $125,000 a year and you spend $175,000 a year, you will go broke. If you make $150,000 a year and you spend $100,000, you will become wealthy. And it is really, really that simple. So if you're making $150,000 a year and you're spending $149,500, you're living too close to the edge. And so when some of these opportunities come up to buy into a practice, to invest in a real estate deal that the group is going to do, to invest in some rental property in your neighborhood, whatever, you don't have the opportunity to invest in that because you haven't given yourself the preparation to be able to do that. So I encourage people to live on sufficiently less than you make that you're able to put some money aside to participate in these things. Like when I'm doing my budget, for example, you know, it's tithing, giving to the church goes right at the top. The next thing is savings. The next thing is, you know, all the basic utilities like your mortgage and, you know, electricity and internet and all that sort of stuff. And then after that, it's, you know, all the discretionary expenses. And one of the categories that's in there is saving for some future opportunity. I call it the next asset class, you know, whatever's the next thing that we might invest in. And maybe that's 2-3 years away. I don't know, but I've got money that I'm socking away every month so that it's just sitting there in a savings account. And that way, whenever the next thing comes up, because opportunities arise, I got money ready to go. And so, yeah, it's not earning anything at the moment, but I'm ready, I'm prepared. And so the next time some opportunity comes available, it's there. But it's very important to have some kind of cushion so that when you have the ability to invest in something, you're not hamstrung by having no margin in your life.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. You know, I moved from San Francisco to Louisiana for exactly that reason, because the cost of living was huge and the salaries weren't huge. And that margin was way too close for my comfort. And when we moved to Louisiana, we basically lived on my husband, who's a urologist, worked for a multi-specialty clinic, his salary alone. And my salary for the 18 months that I was an employed physician, my salary went entirely to savings to launch my practice and to build the building and to build the ASC. And even once we moved into the building, opened my practice, we actually lived on his salary for the next 4 years and reinvested every dollar of profit into building the next thing, exactly as you're saying. So I could not agree with that more wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly wise and very prudent choice. One of the mistakes that I think people make very often is that what you'll find is that after medical school, you'll have a series of sudden jumps in your income, probably a half a dozen times over the course of the next 15 years. So you'll have a jump going from residency to your first attending paycheck, let's say. Then you'll have a jump when you make partner. Then you'll have a jump when you start being able to invest in some of these other ancillary services or real estate deals or whatever. So you'll have times when your income has been largely stagnant more or less for a period of some years. And then all of a sudden there's a big jump. And the tendency that we have is to expand our lifestyle to exactly the level of our new income. And I think that's a big mistake that people make. And so what you're describing is, I think, a very prudent choice. What I call the 15% rule. So whenever you have a big jump in your income, expand your lifestyle 15%, not 95%. Okay. So a 15% lifestyle change is big. You can do a lot. You can do a lot with that. But start with that and, you know, save the rest, invest the rest, use the rest to pay down debt, and, you know, at least do that for 6 months. And if you can get through that and you have the discipline to do that and you look around and you're like, you know, we're doing really well. We're making a lot of progress towards our goal. I think we want to expand another 5% because we've got these travel opportunities we want to start doing that we've never been able to take advantage of. Okay, fair enough. You're making a rational, non-emotional, calculated decision as opposed to just, yeah, we got money, impulse buy, let's do this thing, right? So, but be intentional, make those decisions, but don't step up your lifestyle all the way up to that margin.
Well, it's really funny because if you think about people who've won the lottery, like big amounts, if you look at the statistics, the majority of those people squander all of that money. Why? Because they've never had that money before. And to them, it's like, oh, I'm a kid in a candy shop. I'm going to go buy X, Y, and Z. And I think physicians tend to do the same thing. And, you know, I think one of the things that has gotten people in trouble is the use of credit cards, because it gives you this false sense of money that you don't have. And one of the, I think, you know, when you talk about that budget and keeping track, yes, nobody wants to make a budget. Okay, so even if you don't make a budget, I would offer that simply having a QuickBooks, if you're using QuickBooks for your practice anyway, for those of us who have their own practice, if you're using QuickBooks anyway, you can create your own company, which in our case is Sandy and Alex. That's the name of the company. We download from our bank statements and our credit card statements every month our expenses. You will be, and then categorize them just like you would any other business expense. We just happen to be the business of Sandy and Alex. The reason I'm telling you that is it's not until you actually start to look at those expenses, even if you don't want to budget for it, even if that blows your mind and you're like, I don't want to be pigeonholed into having to stick to my budget. If you simply download those expenses, categorize it, you will be dumbfounded by where your money is going. Because sometimes I think we tend to like underestimate how much we spend dining out, or how much we underestimate how much we spent on that thing that only seemed like the trip to Starbucks, right? That people talk about. It was only $5, except if you do it 30 times a month, it's not $5.
Yeah. Two of the top five categories I typically see on spending is Amazon purchases and eating out. Those are two of the big five for physicians I've found. It's a good exercise to do. Just go through your credit card statements from the last 3 months and just categorize everything and say, okay, how much went to eating out? How much went to Amazon? How much went to clothes? How much went to, you know, whatever, and just put them all in categories. It's going to blow your mind. First time, my wife and I did that. We were surprised how much we were spending on eating out. We're like, oh man, we can cut that way back. And we just didn't realize what it was. And so until you know, it's just like you got the patient who comes into your office and they're diabetic and their hemoglobin A1C is 9. And you say, take the next month and track your sugars. And then come back and we'll talk. And they come back and they're like, holy cow, doc, I had no idea. I was tracking 350 sugars 4 times a day. I had no idea. Okay. So they're paying attention now. Now they know what the numbers are and you start to make some adjustments.
Well, it's no different than obesity medicine, right? You know, hey doc, I can't lose any weight. Oh, and I hardly eat anything. Okay. We'll keep track of how much you eat. Right. And then all of a sudden they come back with this diary and no, they don't eat that much. They hardly eat anything all day long. But when they're eating things that are so calorie dense, like that entire chocolate cake, that of course you're not losing any weight, right? It's the same idea. So, you know, I think the thing in medicine, you know, is this concept of delayed gratification. We, you know, particularly if you have been married in med school or in residency, and you guys have not made a whole lot of money, and you're thinking, okay, well, now's, you know, we're finally making some money. Now's my chance to do something, you know, and spend it and go places, et cetera. But I think that, you know, just like you need to write a business plan for where do I want my career to head, whether it's, you know, even if you stay in academics, but maybe it's, you know, I want to start a practice, or I want to grow a practice, or whatever you're thinking, you have to have a plan for how do I get to that endpoint. You know, I think whether you're looking at a practice that you want to grow and ultimately sell to other partners as your exit strategy, or whether you want to sell it to private equity. I know everybody's going to go, oh my God, that's a terrible word. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the options, right? Or whether you're thinking, I'm going to build or buy into this endoscopy center, but now I'm, you know, at an age where I want to be bought out of the endoscopy center. All of these things require an exit strategy, okay? And your finances for how to get there are no different, okay? You can't at the time you want to retire, wake up and go, oh, I want to retire in 2 years. I should have been thinking about this all along. You have to actually have a plan for, I think I want to retire at X age, and I think I'm going to need this amount of money to get there, and this is how I'm going to get there. It's no different than anything else that requires a business plan. And I think that when it comes to, you know, that relationship with your spouse, especially as you're considering starting or buying into things, there has to be a plan for how that fits. Would you agree with that?
100%. And you need to be prepared for the plan to change over time also. So the plan that you make with your spouse when you're first married is probably not going to hold you for the next 35 to 50 years. So because things change, right? So you get a different job, you develop different dreams, you have kids, you decide that one of you wants to quit working. I mean, all of those things need to be taken into account, and you can't know that early on. So yeah, you need a plan. You need to set long-term goals. You need to start working towards those long-term goals, and periodically you need to come together and say, is this still really what we want? Or do we need to be thinking about other things? Or just come together and say, you know what? I know we talked about me retiring when I'm, you know, 65, but I don't know if I want to work that long. I think I might want to retire earlier. Well, how would that change our plans? Well, have that discussion. Yeah, you can always change things. It's your life. Personal finance is personal.
Well, but I think, you know, personal finance is really no different than any business. I mean, you really are running the business of your own life, if you think about it, right? And ultimately, the issue is whether it's a business or it's your own personal finances, it's not set it and go. All right. You know, yes, you know, we can have a whole conversation about investment strategies and how you don't try and time the market, and it's really about long-term investing and all of these other concepts. But at the end of the day, whatever plan you have, whatever strategy you have, to your point, needs either quarterly, at least once a year, reevaluation of, is the plan working? Do I want to stay with, to your point, do I want to stay with this plan? Am I changing the plan? I will tell you, and I said this to you in an email between us, we spent an hour every weekend looking at where we were, where we were headed, and were we on target, and how did we have to change that plan if needed. Now, I'm not advocating that other people spend an hour every weekend. I'm probably a little more compulsive than most people. But the only way you get to where you're going is if you're constantly tweaking it.
Yeah.
How often do you guys review your plan?
Well, at this point, so Catherine and I have been married for 14 years and change. So probably about once a year. I would say about once a year, plus anytime there's some major change. So we usually review it at the beginning of the year. But like, for example, this last year, I got out of the military and joined a private practice. So big events like that, we'll come back and reassess. You know, as we're getting ready to think about buying into the practice next year and becoming a partner, big changes, you know, big ticket items. So we come together over that. When we were first married, it was a lot more frequent. I mean, we would pretty much talk about financial stuff, I would say at least once a month when we were doing the budget, sometimes a couple times a month. But, you know, the more you do it, the longer you do it, the less often you need to come together, because it just becomes more organic, just like anything else. And so over time, it just became less critical to do it as frequently, because we knew what we were wanting to do. We had each other's best interests in mind. And we were able to look at a longer term time horizon. So it gets a little easier over time, I think.
I think that that's absolutely true, because at this point, it's just sort of part of the daily discussion and not something that we actually have to have a formal conversation about. And I have to say, though, that, you know, people talk about the fact that the worst financial event that can ever happen to you is getting divorced. And it's true. And I would tell you that the way in which you keep your marriage sane is to have these conversations often. And I know so many people who have the head in the sand approach, and that doesn't actually work.
It cuts both ways too. So I know some people will have their head in the sand in the sense that they don't want to know about it, and they just don't want to hear anything about it. They don't want to participate. And I know some people that have their head in the sand, like they want to keep everything to themselves, you know, keep control over everything and not share it. And I think both approaches really are problematic. So if you're married, you need to be working together. You need joint bank accounts. You need to be sharing information with each other. You need to know where all your money is and where it's going. And so what I usually recommend for folks is have one person in the marriage be the household CFO. And so they're in charge of managing the budget and balancing the checkbook and making sure all the investments are going to the right place, making sure the bills are all getting paid, because they're a little bit more, maybe they're more nerdy, and maybe they're just more interested in the money side. Maybe they're just a little bit more savvy with it. Maybe it's just less stressful for them. They have one person that's designated as the CFO, and they come together, but, or they take care of all that. But then the spouses come together for making decisions, and the household CFO isn't the only one who makes decisions. They're bringing the information to the other person, and the other person is required to participate. So you can't stick your head in the sand and go, no, I trust you, I'm sure it's fine. No. That is a recipe for resentment and bitterness. And frankly, the household CFO doesn't know everything, whether it's whoever it is in the relationship, it doesn't matter. They don't know everything, and neither do you. You're married, you're one person, you're one family, you got to work together.
So, to that end, tell us a little bit about your upcoming summit, Marriage and Money MD, and why people should sign up. The link is going to be in the show notes below, but tell us a little bit about what we're going to get out of coming to your summit.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited about this. This is going to be an awesome, awesome time. So it's a 3-day live summit from November 15th through 17th. And it's going to be, we're going to have 3 nights of speakers. We're going to have 21 physicians and physician spouses coming to speak about various topics related to marriage and money. So we're going to be talking about communication, conflict resolution, parenting, sex and intimacy, budgeting, real estate investment, setting a long-term financial plan, you know, how to teach your kids about money. I mean, we're just going to run the gamut. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be so fun. We've got just a killer lineup of speakers. They're going to be great. And so it's free to attend. Anybody can come sign up for it at www.marriageandmoneymd.com. And so it's absolutely free. And if you can't catch it live, you'll be able to catch the replays for the rest of the week. And it is going to be awesome. And so this is a date night that is worth investing in, and you don't have to invest anything. That's the best part. So like, Sandy was saying, you know, divorce is the number one thing that will derail your financial plan. Nothing hurts your financial goals like having to divide your wealth in half. And I always say date night is the best insurance policy that you have against that. So this is a great date night. It's going to be so much fun. And people can sign up for free at marriageandmoneymd.com.
And you should bring your spouse.
Absolutely. The more the merrier. So, and if you can't watch it together, catch the replays together the next day.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Brent. This has been great.
Thanks, Andy. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. Please be sure to sign up for my newsletter below. I'll be sending you tips on how to start a practice, grow a practice, and then add multiple services so that you can maximize your revenue.